Welcome to Security Architecture Podcast, where we help cybersecurity professionals to stay ahead of the curve and ensure they are successful in their cybersecurity journey.
Hi, I'm Evgeny.
I'm Dimitri.
We have here Trevor from Beyond Trust. Trevor, can you please introduce yourself and the company?
Hey guys, thanks. This is Trevor Combs. I'm a sales engineer here at Beyond Trust and really excited to meet with you guys today. Again, Beyond Trust, we specialize in remote access, secure remote access solutions for third-party vendor and internal help desk.
First question we're asking is, what's the name of the offering or product that's addressing the remote access by Beyond Trust?
Yeah, so we actually have two product lines here at Beyond Trust that our clients use for remote access. We have our Beyond Trust remote support and our Beyond Trust privileged remote access solutions. Remote support is primarily used for our service desk folks and our service desk customers, helps them easily secure basically remote support into servers, workstations, mobile devices, et cetera. And then we have our privileged remote access, which is used primarily by IT staff and vendors, mainly to enable access and monitor access maybe from third parties or privileged inside users as well.
So let's start and dive in to an architecture. We are architecture podcast, and we would like to learn more about how you guys design your solution, how many maybe POPs you have, if it's a cloud solution, if it's an on-prem solution, how you do high availability, latency, and all the good stuff. If you want to share a screen, or do you want to talk about it anyway?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to share the screen here. So this is kind of the general picture of architecture. What's nice, too, is I mentioned that we have two different solutions. We have the remote support solution, and then we have the privileged remote access solution. The great thing is they're both built from the same core foundation. So we are an appliance-based solution. It's a black box, lightweight Linux appliance. What's nice about that solution is it can be pretty much hosted with any tenant that a customer might want. We have a physical solution. So customers that still need to do that rack-mountable physical appliance, we can also do virtualized in form of OVA. Customer can throw that into VMware, Hyper-V. Customers can even publish it into AWS or Azure as well. And so it really gives them a lot of different options, as well as us having our cloud model where we can actually spin up a dedicated instance as well. And we host all that infrastructure for the customer. One thing I like about that when we talk about that appliance-based solution is our customers don't gain or lose any features or functionality or security regardless of how they decide to host it. It's the same footprint across all of those different hosting platforms. One of the things I'll add here too is we like to say, you know, give folks access without having to give them a VPN. So compared to some other solutions out there, we're not a VPN. We don't have to work in conjunction with a VPN. Instead, we're replacing that need for a VPN altogether.
Just to understand, I'm a user and I want to connect to Australia or to Toronto or to New York. Mm-hmm. I will need to have a solution in three of these locations. And from my station, I want to have some kind of a client or clientless access where I'm going to be logging in directly to the solution.
Yeah. So the way the solution is designed is we can go from a single deployment, as you kind of see on the screen now, or also having a high availability model as well. So a lot of my global customers, right? I might have somebody in New York, I have someone else in Sydney. And instead of having to go across the pond for all that connectivity, all that data transmission, we also have a footprint called Atlas, which allows us to deploy additional appliances as traffic nodes. So let's say you are in Sydney, you're trying to access resources in Sydney. Instead of you having to go back and forth across the pond, we may have another node stood up in Sydney. So that way we're able to minimize the latency, right? The bandwidth latency and keep you connected and keep about 98% of the traffic right there within that appliance. But what's also nice about this is our customers can still have multiple nodes deployed across the globe, but still manage that within a single deployment, meaning I don't have to manage the Sydney appliance separately and the New York appliance, et cetera, but we can offload the bulk of that traffic to that localized node. It helps us out with things like GDPR, right? When we're very concerned about localization of the data and the connectivity.
So what you're saying is that your customers can use these appliances or, of course, virtual machine that they can deploy on AWS instance, and they actually manage and own the solution that does all of this connectivity and perhaps even traffic optimization.
Yeah, and I think that's the great way, the great concept around the different deployment strategies, right? So cloud subscription, right? Pretty much anywhere you go. But when we talk about perpetual, actually owning the solution, managing the solution, That doesn't mean it has to be a physical appliance, right? That can be in the customer's cloud, to your point. It can be virtualized. They can have multiple different flavors of it, right? One might be, you know, VM data center. One might be an AWS, might be Azure, but they can all still work together in a single deployment.
But there will not be two customers running on the same appliance, right? So there's no such thing that I'm sharing my appliance with someone else.
Correct. Yeah. And that's the great thing about cloud. Even if it's cloud and it's subscription, it's not your traditional SaaS, right? That we think about from years past where it's, you know, 50 servers and 700 customers are all sharing those 50 servers. Our customers that deploy with us in cloud, they get their own dedicated instance spun up that we manage for them. So that way everything is still a single tenant type of deployment.
Trevor, when I connect, do I have access to specific applications that I use? How do I control the policy?
Yeah, so you know, a couple different layers there, or guardrails, if you will. So when you're logging into the solution as a user, you know, an authorized user, one is your authentication there. So you can use pretty much any provider identity access management that we want to use. So anything from Active Directory, a SAML connector, right, a Radius connector, Kibros, whatever it might be that you're already using. And then we have group policies in the product that the customer can build, delete, modify, whatever it might be. So when you're logging in, we can match those policies up to those existing providers. And that's going to dictate granular permission sets of not only what you can see, where you can go, but also what features within the product you can use, because there are about 80 different granular things that you can do. And then once you're in, we then are able to create what we call jump groups, which is then going to show you the resources or the destinations that you should have access to. And so giving you that kind of two levels of delegation, if you will, and then also another layer of approvals and workflows built into the product too for maybe some of those sensitive assets, right? Especially when we're talking about third-party vendors. You might give a third-party vendor access to the solution, but then when they want to actually access something, we might want to make sure that's maybe in a change window or it's, you know, appropriately being accessed at the right time. And so having that extra layer of guardrail, if you will, of those approvals is built in as well.
And when it comes to the connectivity and the connection itself, do you have authentication on every single connection that's going on from the client to one of the appliances or the nodes?
Yes, yeah, so the way it's working is when you're actually connecting to the solution as a consumer, as a user, you're actually either connecting through, we have a thick client that can be downloaded, but more popular is it's a fully HTML5 web interface. So you as the user, you hit the URL of the appliance for the login, you authenticate. Once you're authenticated, you're going to see the list of connections that you have, whether that's an RDP connection, maybe a web URL, an SSH connection, a VNC, whatever it might be. And then when you actually attempt to access that connection, if you have rights to do so, there's no additional approvals on it, you're also going to need to authenticate to the endpoint as well. And that's another feature that we have built in where we have what we call the on-appliance vault, which is kind of a lightweight version, if you will, of a password-safe management product. So we have a full-blown enterprise product as well that we integrate with. But for customers that are really just looking for that initial get in there for privileged access, that remote access, we then have a vault. And so from there, when you actually, maybe let's say you're trying to make an RDP connection to a server or you're trying to SSH to a network device, you are then presented with a list of credentials, if they're available, that you have access to. You select the credential you want to use to authenticate to that endpoint, and then we seamlessly inject that into the connection to the endpoint. So we're able to obfuscate and ensure that those credentials don't have to sit in the back pocket, right, of the users consuming them, but we can still get that user access to the resource in a secure fashion. And all of that traffic, all that connectivity, as you can kind of see here on the diagram, the nice green arrows, whether it's the consumer of the solution, they're connecting outbound over 443 traditionally over a TLS encrypted connection. And the customer, what's nice about this too, I used to be a consumer of the solution before I joined Beyond Trust about 4 years ago, is the customer's in full control of the TLS certificate, the TLS versioning, the cipher suite, everything is in full control, whether it's cloud or on-premises. And then from the endpoint perspective, we have two connection methodologies. We have a client-based approach, a one-to-one called a jump client that can actually be installed as a service. Or we have our jump point, which is a small service that can be put on a customer's Linux or Windows box that's then providing that outbound connection back to the appliance to deliver that session securely as well. So the end user never has to physically connect to the endpoint like a traditional VPN. So that can also ensure that we're not having to worry about uninspected machines or potential malware on an end user or consumer's machine. It's really more of a session that we're allowing them to interact with while keeping it all isolated and brokered and managed at the appliance level.
Very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about your licensing model. How do you license the product? Is it seats, users, devices? From my understanding, there is a remote support and privilege remote access.
Our remote support solution, which is more of that service desk, right, that support entity realm, that is licensed based on concurrent technicians, so concurrent consumer of the solution, a user that's logging in, using the solution to provide support to an end user. That's based on concurrent users, so not named users. So that way, you know, if you need X capacity, you've got it all built in. You don't have to worry about naming those licenses. The privileged remote access solution that we're talking about here as well, that is traditionally based on the number of unique endpoints that the customer wants to connect to. So they don't have to be named. So if I say I've got, you know, 300 servers or 300 destinations, they'd license it for 300 endpoints. When we get into those higher numbers, we do also offer a concurrent user model in our privileged remote access. Traditionally, customers that have 50,000 plus endpoints, sometimes it's a little more cost beneficial for them to go the route of concurrent user versus endpoint. It just really depends on what's going to make the most sense for the customer. But it really, I'd say traditionally though, if it's less than 20, 30,000 endpoints, the concurrent endpoint model is how we license.
Trevor, I have another question. How would you scale, say if I have an office and I have remote connectivity, how many concurrent sessions I can support with one appliance?
Yeah, that's one thing I love about the appliance is it's built to scale without having to add a lot of extra infrastructure. The appliance is designed to handle as few as 20 concurrent users all the way up to 1,000 concurrent users, and then as little as 100 endpoints or as many as 50,000 endpoints on a single appliance. And with it being more of a black box Linux core, we like to call it Beyond Trust Linux because we strip away all the things that we don't need. That really allows us to, you know, take advantage without having to overblow the resources, especially if a customer is running this virtually, right, or in the cloud. We know there's a cost there, right, you know, having to pay for those resources. So versus, you know, maybe a traditional Windows server where you might need 64 gigs of RAM, I believe our largest build requires around 16 gigs of RAM to support that large capacity that I talked about. So very small footprint, but very scalable for our customers.
Is there any use cases when the customer asks you to connect to SaaS applications and they want you to control how they're going to access them?
Yeah, so I would say some of the SaaS application examples I see are typically the web-based applications. I'll give one example. I've got one customer that, you know, they want to provide their engineering team and some of their outsourced contractors access to their AWS environment. But again, they want to manage those credentials. They want to understand when they're going in, how those sessions, what they're doing in those sessions. And so they'll utilize privileged remote access here to do a web-based call to AWS, even though it's an external facing URL. They're forcing those customers though, those consumers to log in through the privileged remote access solution. So that way they can not only manage that connection, but also have an audit trail. They know what they did while they were in there and they can see a recording.
Can you describe a bit more about audit trail and recording? Because I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So every single session that a consumer initiates on the product, whether it's RDP, a web-based jump, VNC, SSH, whatever it might be, the appliance, again, is managing that session, right? It's brokering that session. And so the customers, if they choose to turn on, and it's very granular, they can, you know, have different direction for it, but everything can be fully screen recorded. So everything the consumer is seeing that they're doing, interacting with on the endpoint is fully screen recorded, as well as a full audit trail of all of the keystroke logging, if they want to go that deep, all the applications that were launched, anything that was done during that session is all logged. And then available through an actual session report and or through Symlog or other integrations for output of data. So every single session, we can go back and see what was or was not done because everything is being done centrally at the appliance while it's being brokered.
The appliance is doing this decryption because, you know, if I'm using SSH, it's a literally encrypted tunnel from me to the server. So the appliance would decrypt that somehow, or actually there is some agent that intercepts that on the endpoint, or is something that happens at the client level?
Yeah, no. So the recording is happening essentially on the appliance. We're not worrying about the end user's machine capturing it, having to send it back up, et cetera. Since the appliance is brokering all the traffic, let me just give it a quick annotation here. All right, so let's start here from a consumer perspective. So this would be an example of a user actually hitting it through the web portal, not having to install any software on their machine. And so we'll go ahead and log in here. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to go ahead. This is an example here of a user logging into the web console. So again, fully HTML5 baked. I don't have to worry about installing any software. When the user is actually logging in, so again, we're doing the authentication. I'm actually logging into the product and I'm launching the web console. And when I logged in here, I was using just standard Active Directory authentication with 2FA, using Okta here on my phone. But again, we can integrate with pretty much any provider in those realms. And then what I'm presented with here as a user is I have these groups here on the left. So these are my jump groups. These are groups that I've been given access to as a vendor or as a user. And then within these groups, I have the connections, the different types of connections that we support. So I'd mentioned, you know, web-based jumps, RDP, our jump client approach, more of our one-to-one client. And within all of these have been configured for me already, so I can see them. And then I can simply interact here. So when I actually trigger one of these connections, what I'm doing is I'm telling the appliance that I'd like to make that connection. And so the endpoints either have a jump client installed on them or using our jump point proxy service that's running, they're connected outbound as well to the appliance over that TLS encrypted connection. And so we're telling them then what to enact. So an example here, I have my Amazon EC2 console, the web-based jump. And so this one is essentially configured to hit a specific URL. So again, this could be an internal application, maybe, that's only accessible to where the jump point is. And when I select this jump, I'm also checking to see if there's any credentials available for this user. And in this case, there is. I'm actually managing an AWS account here, tcoms.aws, and it's in my credentials store. So again, instead of me as the user having to know that account, and this account's being managed on the appliance through our vault, I can simply select the account that I want access to. And then we're telling that jump point now through the appliance to go make that outbound web connection for us. Once that web connection is initiated, we're actually also picking a credential here. So we're going to actually attempt to automatically log into that web URL with that credential. And we're not going to display the content to the user here until we've actually submitted a password, because we don't want to accidentally maybe expose something that the web page isn't working properly, right? We don't want to show any clear text. And then here now we're seeing the web URL delivered back to us. And this is all going through the PRA product, through the appliance. Now, since the appliance is managing and proxying this connection for us, all of the auditing, the recording, is all happening while that's in transit. So I don't have to worry about my machine capturing it. The endpoint isn't doing anything extra to capture it. Instead, as that session's in progress, everything that I do here is fully recorded and fully audited. And so now I can interact with the actual experience. You see here, I do have like the URL here. It's presenting that to me, but we're not allowing the user to change any of that. So again, we're using the appliance up here to connect actually to a URL, to a web-based application.
So what you're getting in your on your side through the browser, is it an image of what's going on?
Yeah, so it's a session replication, right? So where the jump point is at on the customer side that's actually making this outbound web call for us is actually spinning up a virtualized web session. And all of that content is being transferred back here for me to interact with and vice versa.
So it's literally who was logged in on my behalf was the appliance. And everything that's happening to appliance transferred to me as an image, and I can interact with this image with my mouse or keyboard.
And the same experience will be with the client, or it's a bit different, I guess?
Yeah, so the thick client that we can actually also install as a user is going to give us the same exact experience. And the only difference there is, if maybe I'm an administrator of the product, there might be some additional functionality that I can do in the thick client that I can't do in the web client. The web client is traditionally going to be used just for consumers of the solution, not necessarily administrators of the solution. And same example here, right? Just as a quick example, you know, that's just a web-based call, but you know, other examples like our jump client or RDP sessions, all of those are readily available to us here. And we're going to then signal to the endpoint that we'd like to make that connection using that jump point or that jump client. And that will then be delivered back to us here within our web console.
And the data that transferred to the appliance, I'm assuming it's transfer over TLS. So what happens is that your AWS credentials were given to the appliance. Appliance went to the website, entered the credentials, and now...
Yeah, so everything is being done through that encrypted TLS session. So on the endpoint, wherever we're making the call at, that's securely connected back to the appliance over outbound connection, right, to the appliance. So that way we don't have to have any inbound connectivity to the customer network. It's all outbound. And all of that is over that TLS encrypted session and delivered back to that jump point that's sitting on that remote network. And that is what's been making that injection of the credential into the RDP, the web, the SSH, whatever type of session it might be. So that way it's end-to-end encrypted from the appliance back over to where it's being started from.
Trevor, with the client, what kind of ports and protocols do I support? Can I VoIP? Can I print? Can I do file
share?
Yeah,
great question. So just a quick example here. Within the traditional protocols, right? So if we don't want to actually have an agent or a client on the other end, using the jump point proxy, which would be put out there somewhere on the customer network, we can support RDP. We can support web-based jumps, as you just saw. We can support VNC as a protocol, SSH, Telnet. We also have a protocol called protocol tunnel jump. And that actually allows some special use cases. So let's say a vendor or a customer needs to actually have a physically direct connected connection. Maybe I'm trying to manage a database with a proprietary tool where I have something very proprietary. Instead of opening up an entire VPN tunnel, that allows us to basically map whatever ports are necessary on the endpoints. And then we're able to map those to the local, like 127.0.0.1 .2, whatever it might be on your local machine, and allow you to have a direct pathway, but we're still utilizing the appliance. It's still an encrypted connection. And we're also able to then screen record the user's machine that they're connecting from. So that way, if they are getting that direct kind of tunnel or port connection, we can still see what they were doing during that interaction. And then of course, outside of those, we also then have our proprietary client, the jump client, which can be installed on the remote machine that can run on Windows, Mac, Linux, headless Linux, even a Raspberry Pi now. And that allows us to lend some additional functionality like direct file transfer, some additional utilities that we can emulate through our clients. And that's how we support this. We don't really support things like printing today. We kind of see that as a security no-no when we're talking about privileged remote access. But all of those traditional protocols are supported out of the box.
And I guess VoIP will not also be working.
Yeah, we're not supporting VoIP because we're not actually making a direct connection back to the user. We're allowing the appliance to have more of an interactive session. So that way we can audit and manage it that way.
So in a way, your client acts as a mini browser and replicate the browser connectivity.
That's a pretty good analogy, right? Yeah, we're creating a session for the user to interact with without directly connecting them, absolutely.
How would your solution work on slow networks? Or, as an example, if I'm roaming between two different networks?
Yeah, absolutely. And this was always really popular as well in our remote support solution, right? When we're troubleshooting things like maybe an end user's VPN connection, et cetera, and then having to start the connection all over again. So to address the connectivity piece first, coming back to the footprint of, you know, the appliance, right, is managing the session and we're connecting and authenticating as a user. So if I am in the coffee shop, I drop my Wi-Fi or I, you know, reconnect to my phone, whatever it might be, I may temporarily lose connection to the appliance myself, but the endpoint connection is still active, right? It's still established. And so based on the thresholds that have been configured, because you can set different timeout thresholds, you know, for security and for user capacity, it might say, hey, what, you know, if I get disconnected, I have 15 minutes to reconnect. The client will attempt to reconnect. So if you've logged in, you know, and it's just one of those quick hiccups in connectivity, we'll try to just reconnect. But if we are changing networks and we've logged out, we'll just simply log back in and our sessions that we had going would still be there readily available for us, because it was us that lost connectivity, not necessarily a session, if you will. And then from a bandwidth management perspective, another really great thing, especially I have a lot of customers, you know, we talked earlier about the ability to deploy additional nodes across the globe, you know, for latency controls, et cetera. I would say the majority of my global customers, though, only have a single appliance deployment with maybe an HA for a failover. They're not actually deploying nodes because of the way that we manage bandwidth. So we actually have an intelligent bandwidth algorithm that we use, and it works twofold. One, during an actual session, if the bandwidth is higher or lower, we're going to use that algorithm to deliver the best possible session experience, because we are talking about displaying, right? We're displaying the session to the user through that graphical interface. And we also give the user, though, the ability to manage that bandwidth experience on their own. So one example, I've got some offshore oil companies, and they've still got some 4G cell cards right out on the oil rigs. And so they said it's almost like, you know, feels like dial-up, even though it's not. They actually start all their sessions in a default black and white grayscale. And so that allows them to really decrease the bit rate that we're having to use, right, in terms of the graphics that they're seeing. But then we're also using dynamic intelligent screen refresh. So traditionally in RDP, right, every second, the entire screen is being refreshed. We're sending back the entire graphic. You know, if I'm working on a server or a system, if I just click the start menu and I just see a small graphic pop up, that's the only part of the screen that we're actually sending back to the user. So we're actually scanning and intelligently only sending back what's changed instead of the entire thing, which really helps us decrease the amount of bandwidth that we have to use for a session. And at the same time, our users can also kick up the experience that we have what's called a high quality video resolution. There's about six different settings they can dynamically change throughout the entire session. And so if they're maybe working with video, right, they're doing some kind of video editing, and they actually need to see as much high res as possible, and they have a really good connection, they can also toggle to that experience as well. So we give the users the control to toggle that through the session, as well as try to manage some of it in an automatic fashion too, when we see, you know, up and down drastic changes in bandwidth.
So what you're saying that your solution is going to work on dial-up?
So I know I've got a couple really older customers, been with us a long time, that have some ISDN connections out there, and they're able to use it. So bless their hearts, you know, that's all they got.
What about reporting?
Yeah, so reporting, what's great is we do give reporting out of the box. Both solutions have comprehensive reporting capability, meaning we've got the ability, I'll just give you an example real quickly. We have the ability to do that granular detail of logging, so keystroke logging, application logging, but also giving you that video recording out of the box as well. And again, all that's happening right on the appliance. Let me just go ahead and bring up another tab here.
But I'm guessing if I want to create, I will only going to go to video reporting if I suspect something malicious happened. How would I know something malicious happened? Oh, could create any reports about usage or abuse or something that will indicate something bad going on?
Yeah, so I don't have any kind of active alerting that we do per se. What I do, though, give our customers the ability to do is to interact fully with the systems that they're using today, like their SIEM tools and their other security tools, right? So we're able to output things like geo information on where people are logging in, failed login attempts, having that extra layer of workflow approvals available as well. So if we do want to add some extra granular layers, so if you're accessing the domain controller at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you probably shouldn't be doing that. We can, you know, provide an approval or have that that alerting available through that outbound SIEM capability. So that way, you know, as you're monitoring those things in real time, we find most of our customers typically that are concerned at that level typically already have some sort of monitoring they have in place for other systems. So instead of trying to recreate another one for them, we're able to integrate directly in with those tools. And then if you are wanting to go in and actually take a little deeper look, that's where we then have all of that reporting and all of that recording available if they have the appropriate permissions to do so.
Trevor, we're actually done with our official part of the show, and we want to move to open questions and conversation. I have a few questions. Yeah. We were talking about policy. So I'm wondering if you can show how to actually control access to applications or where you can go and what you can do with the account.
Absolutely. Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, we integrate right with those existing security providers that a customer might already be using for onboarding and offboarding today. And so within that, then we have our own group policies. And so that's really your first layer of the authentication process, right? That identity access process. So here's an example. I just have a few listed here, but this gives us that granularity capability. So if I was going here to my IT operations, let's go to our IT operations group. This then gives us the ability to, one, come in here and specify which provider we might be using. So this is an Active Directory structure. I can come in, I can find the appropriate security groups, OUs, et cetera, add those to it. But then we can go much more deep into what a person can actually do in the solution. Do they have access to reporting? Do they have access to any administrative functionality? Do they have access to the different types of session management? And then once we get into that, we can even get into the types of session policies they have. So can they do RDP? Can they do jump clients? Maybe they see a group.
Can I choose to which RDP Windows servers they can go and which ones they cannot, or which web application? So let's say I have an internal SharePoint and internal Wiki. Can I restrict by this?
So those will be based on the groupings that those applications or those servers would actually be in as well. So that's when that kind of second layer comes into play. And that's when we're actually talking about what we call our jump groups. So just to give you a quick example here of that as well. I'm just going to log into my FAT console here. So we talked about the groups, right, that we saw on the web client earlier. So within each one of these groups, we have those connections. So each connection has to be a member of at least one group. It can be a member of more than one group as well. And so when I log in, if I'm a member of the vendor group here, I'm going to see these connections. And then if I have web jump capability, I could maybe initiate this web jump, but maybe I don't have shell jump, right? Because maybe I need to have access to this group, but I don't let the user maybe initiate that type of connection. So that's kind of how we do that granularity, if you will, or that siloing of what you can access once you get into the product. And then in addition to that, you also then have that ability like I talked about where we can do access layer approvals. So we might have additional approvals on top of that. Or even this is also where integration with things like ServiceNow or other ITSM tools come into play, where maybe, you know, I come here and I click on a connection and I'm presented with an incident number or a change ticket. And I have to actually put that in and then we'll actually call that system and we'll validate the user, the system, the time, and see if we should even grant them access at that point in time as well. So giving you some extra layers there as well when it comes to what you can access. Just because you can see it doesn't mean maybe you can hit it right now.
Trevor, you mentioned you can deploy in BeyondTrust Cloud. So host it. So if I have on-prem infrastructure or maybe in AWS and you host the appliance, how the appliance from your cloud connect back to my premises?
Yeah, so that's going to be where we're talking about those jump clients or those jump points. So that would then be installed on the endpoint or on the jump point machine that you want to have, maybe in that AWS infrastructure or in that on-prem infrastructure. And again, those are going to talk outbound back to our appliance. And that's going to resolve over that 443, over that DNS connection using that TLS encrypted connection out. So it's always going to be out from your network back to the appliance. That way we don't have to worry about poking inbound holes or having any direct connections back.
Is this clients need to be installed on each server where we need access?
Yeah, so that's kind of that one-to-one or that one-to-many. So if I just bring up my architecture slide here again real quickly, We've got the Jump client. So that's more of that direct connection, right? I've got a single server listed. I want to connect directly to it using our proprietary client. Maybe I don't have any other ports open. I don't want to use RDP for whatever reason, or, you know, SSH. Or again, more traditionally, what I usually see in most of my customers though, is they don't want to put, you know, another agent or another client. Agent's kind of a bad word sometimes, right? So they use our Jump Point service. They throw that on a Windows or a Linux box. And that now is the box that just has to have access outbound to the resources you want to connect to. So these yellow lines here would be those legacy protocols. So the Jump Point makes the outbound RDP connection, but it's delivering it out back to the appliance over that TLS encrypted session. And that's more of that one-to-many approach.
Thank you.
I have a question of integration. So let's assume that we have the 5,000 employees. How would you go about integrating your solution in such an enterprise company?
Yeah, so when we talk about integrations, you know, we talked a little bit already about authentication, right? So we're covered there. We know we can get the users logged in using the company's existing provider. When we talk about integrations, anything from, you know, ITSM, help desk management software, we have a handful of pre-built integrations that we offer in-house. We have a lot of partners that also build integrations. You know, ServiceNow is probably our flagship integration. You know, Cheryl out there, they build their own integration with our remote support product. And then we've got some SIM integrations. I think what's great though is we do have an API, and the API is getting even more robust and robust every release. But giving us the ability to create these endpoints, right? Manage these endpoints, manage these groups, manage the user groupings, the security groups, all that information can be done through the API robustly as well. So when I talk integration, you know, it's always great to have an out-of-the-box, cool, I just click a button and install something. But I think what's really getting more popular, though, is the ability to have that open API so that way customers can integrate the way they want. Because we still run into a lot of customers that have a lot of their own homegrown solutions internally when it comes to ITSM or their monitoring or their change management. So being able to allow those solutions to integrate with us through the API is really powerful as well.
And how are you onboarding the 5,000 users that you have?
So the onboarding there, you know, if we're talking about internal users, I think that's where that security provider integration comes into play. So it's not like I'm having to come and add, right, Dimitri into the solution, add him to this group, right? Instead, Dimitri's in maybe the service desk one or the enterprise operations security group in Active Directory. And so back on that screen where we had the actual provider, it looks like it. Yeah, so here, so we've got our security providers here. So in this example, I've just got an Active Directory connection set up, but then we can maybe make this Azure AD, whatever it might be. Then over here in my group policies, I've got my IT operations group. I simply come in here and I come to my provider. Here's my LDAP. I find the appropriate group and add it. So that way we're still following your normal onboarding and offboarding processes, right? You don't have to come add the users. We're just adding the groups from the providers that you have today. So if you've onboarded them, they can come log in. You offboard them, they can't log in. Because every time you log into our solution, we're going to attempt to hit a security provider and make that authentication.
And there is no need to distribute any client to the end users, right? Because they use the browser.
Yeah, I mean, they can use the FAT client, but I think the really powerful part is what I showed earlier, is you can just log into the web. So an HTML5-enabled browser, and they're good to go. And that's usually very popular in the our customers that are using the solution for third-party vendors. That drives a lot of good adoption, right? Instead of having to install a VPN client or a security certificate, instead they just tell their vendors, hey, here's the URL, here's where you log in at. And that makes it very lightweight for them. They don't have to install and manage any application stacks there.
Are there any questions to us?
No, I just really enjoyed the time and I really enjoyed the podcast. I've gotten hooked since I heard about it a few months ago. So,
Thank you. Where people can find more about Beyond Trust, and we will share links in the episode, but maybe just quick note, you or the company.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you got to love the internet, right? So, you know, beyondtrust.com, we have an amazing site with tons of information, tons of ways to get information without having to sign up for something, but also great ways to be able to reach out if anybody has any additional questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Please remember to subscribe to our podcast and join us for our next episode.